The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I hear we've got a whole slew of new questions. Jim called for some additional Social Security questions last week, and sounds like people responded. So we've got at least a couple of Social Security questions today, and then we'll dig into some other things. Jim is coming through loud and clear from his the resort where he has a nice view of the snowscape in Colorado this week. Right through your windows. Aren't you in the sunroom?
I am in the sunroom. Yes, mm-hmm. I am.
Yeah. Nice view today.
Yeah, it's not too bad. The sun is out.
Mm-hmm.
Snow's melting. Trees still have snow on the branches. It's pretty nice.
See, it's like a resort down there.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as saying a resort. The room I'm in is now my basement. Technically, because all the stuff that was in the basement that got flooded out when my pipes burst is now in this room.
Now up in
so
the
I really
sunroom.
Don't have much room to move around in anymore.
Well, you don't need to move. You got to stay close to the microphone anyway. So,
but I got to get that basement fixed. Yeah. Got to get that done. Got to get my operation done. Got to get the business mm-hmm. running. No wonder Perfect. I don't have a girlfriend.
You don't need one. You got plenty to do already.
No, trust me. There's times I need one. But... Anyways, I am in the sunroom, and it's nice. Mm-hmm. And I want to jump into questions, folks. No time for bantering. I know Chris is on a very tight schedule. Mm-hmm. We put out a call last week for Social Security questions. And Chris, we have enough questions where we could probably do two Q&A shows
nice.
Dedicated just to Social Security. So,
well, if we get too far behind, we'll do one of those dedicated shows. But
yeah, if I can't make a recording, you can do a dedicated mm-hmm. show of just Social Security questions.
Yeah.
But I want to lead with two, maybe three Social Security questions and then jump into some non-Social Security questions. How's okay. that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay, so first one begins. It's a short question. I don't know how long the answer will be, but it's a short question. It says, hello, Jim and Chris. I really enjoy your podcast and have listened to just about all of them. That would be a long-time listener if they listened to all of them.
Yeah. I'm just trying to do in my mind how many that would be. That would be a lot.
But so. I think they get deleted after a while, don't they?
Oh,
I
so maybe
remember.
Not all of them are on there. But if you were doing all of them, that would be about, wow. For a while, we only did one a week. But we've been doing two a week for the last couple... Two, 3 years.
A couple of years, yeah. We've been doing two a week.
We did one a week before that, so there'd be a ton of those out there. But
yeah, I can't remember if they stay on the web forever or if they end up going.
I'll check and see how old they go back there. We don't want people listening to them when they're too old, because a lot of times the rules have changed and
true.
Laws change regarding things in retirement, like taxes on IRAs and the treatment of IRAs and Social Security rules, and things change over time. So it's best to keep you listening to the last couple years, probably.
Okay, well, this question begins. He says, I have a Social Security question. I'm a resident of Reno, Nevada, mm-hmm. and I retired December 1st, 2020. When I retired, I received severance. Half of my severance was paid in December of 2020, and the other half was paid the beginning of February 2021.
Okay.
Federal Social Security and Medicare taxes were withheld from my severance payments. Mm-hmm. The February severance payment will be my only income in 2021, and it is large enough where it will put me above the maximum earnings subject to Social Security taxation. Question, will this severance payment be included in my Social Security earnings history for purposes of calculating my future retirement benefit? Second question, are you guys taking new clients?
Which one do you want to answer first?
Why don't you start with the Social Security one, okay, and then you can address okay the second one as well.
Okay. First question essentially is, does severance pay count in your earnings record towards creating your Social Security retirement benefit? Simple answer, yes. The Supreme Court actually in the past has ruled that severance pay is treated as regular wages. And as you noticed, they withheld income taxes withholding, and they withheld payroll taxes, Medicare and Social Security taxes from those payments, as they should have. And so, yes, sounds like you had a nice payment in February of 2021, which gives you an entire extra year of maximum Social Security withholdings. So you're getting an extra year in your earnings record, even though you didn't work a day. Think of severance pay as your regular pay for work. You just aren't required to go into work. They're just paying you to be home, essentially. That's kind of how I always envision severance pay versus other types of pay that you might receive after you stop working. So, yes, severance pay, absolutely. There was apparently a question in the past that got elevated all the way to the Supreme Court. But I do know the Supreme Court in the past, I can't give you the date, ruled that severance pay is for payroll taxes in particular, to be treated as regular wages. So, yeah, you're going to see 2021, your maximum earnings, which when he said his single payment in February of 2021 is going to exceed the maximum taxable earnings for Social Security, that means that payment in February was above $142,800. So what that taxable earnings maximum essentially says is they're not going to collect Social Security taxes above that. But in your earnings record, they're not going to give you credit for anything above the $142,800. That seems fair, right, on both hands. They don't give you credit for it, but they also don't collect Social Security taxes above that maximum limit. So he'll have an additional year of maxed out Social Security earnings in 2021 as part of his earnings record, which will determine his retirement benefit. He didn't share his age, so I can't opine anymore about when it'll go into effect and that sort of thing. But yes, at some point that will be reflected. Social Security won't have that information until later on in 2021, so you won't see it right away. Obviously, they don't give you a 2021 earnings report until after 2021 has lapsed. So next year, if you get an estimate from Social Security, you'll see that added to your earnings record at Social Security. Lengthy answer, I guess. It was a simple answer, yes. Sorry to go on and on and on in gym style, I'll call that. The second question is, are we taking new clients? Kind of, I guess. Is depends on what you're looking for. Our base retirement planning process, which is kind of the essence of what we tout, our whole process of analyzing your minimum dignity floor, doing the projections, see what that looks like, looking at your secure income, judging whether you have adequate secure income to match that minimum dignity floor level, looking at your distributions to cover fund spending, looking at survivorship scenarios and basic tax projections, all of that is what I mean by our base retirement plan. That's pretty booked up through this year, honestly, through 2021. So if you have an imminent retirement decision that's going to be determined by what you see from a process like that, it's going to be a little tough to get in a near term. We do have space in our asset management program. We don't talk a lot about asset management on the podcast, but we will. There'll be, I believe, a dedicated show coming up in the next, probably in the next 60 days, where we talk about how we do it. Just like in the retirement planning process, we don't do things as traditionally as many places do. On the asset management side, I think we do things in a more modern, straightforward way than is, quote, traditional. But we'll get into those details in the future. So if you're looking for that aspect, even before you might do a retirement plan with us or someone else, we do have some openings for that in the nearer term. We'll be able to do a bit of tax planning work for people even before they've done a retirement plan on a case-by-case basis later on this year as well. Kind of, again, depends on what you're looking for. So if you send us an email describing what you're looking for, we can tell you kind of a reasonable amount of time to expect before we could get to addressing your issue if we're a good fit for the issue that you described to us in your email. But the base retirement plan itself, fairly booked through this year, and so if you know you're going to be retiring or plan to retire in the next 2 to 3 years and you want us to process the retirement plan, I'd reach out to us now, get on that queue, which is going to have some time. But then, you know, late this year, early next year, should still be in plenty of time for you to get an answer, get some information that will help you in your retirement decision if you're not retiring for a few years.
Perfect. The one thing that I would add, is the microphone on?
It is.
Excellent. All right. I can never remember which way to turn it on. So Bob, who does tax planning, folks, he will be available to start doing Roth conversion analysis, withdrawal analysis, and tax optimization. Much more advanced tax planning than many, many firms offer. But he will be available for that and doesn't have the queue that Chris has. Sometime after tax filing season, so that'll be towards mid to late April. I know Bob, when they extended the tax filing season, if you don't know, folks, they extended it to May 15th. That gave you another month.
Well, plus a bonus 2 days, because May 15th is a Saturday, so technically May 17th is the deadline.
Well, my personal CPA, who does business taxes, Bob is a personal tax person, folks. He doesn't do the business taxes. So we have a business CPA and we have Bob. Both of them have said they want to be done by April 15th.
Yeah,
like,
I don't
the hell
blame
with
them.
The extension. Yeah, exactly. I want to
be done.
Done.
Yeah. It just prolongs the pain for those
it does.
Folks.
It prolongs for the poor CPAs. Like, oh, great, another month of this crap. Yeah. But I know both of them want to be done by April 15th. Then they're both going on a short little mini vacation, and then they'll be back into the swing of things. And Bob will be available for tax planning. So do keep that in mind. The queue, if you will, at our firm is Chris's retirement planning that he does. We have a staff of four people, Chris and Greg and Junior, and they do all the planning, and they are quite busy. It's planning in our eyes is not scalable. It is very labor intensive, and they're very methodical. So that's where the slowdowns generally occur. So anyways, good question, but that's about all we want to say on that. Let's get into another Social Security question, shall we?
Sounds good.
This one's a twofer. So it's one question, but with two parts. So it's technically three questions, but you treat it whichever way you want.
Okay.
So it says, hello, Jim and Chris. Here are some questions for your consideration. We're a married couple, both born in 1954. Neither of us have started Social Security. We have very similar earnings histories. Mm-hmm. In August, my wife's benefit will be on her next birthday. This August, my wife's benefit will be $3,014. Let's just call it $3,000, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
My benefit as of last month will be $3,120.
Mm. Almost the same, yeah.
My wife is retired. I'm still working. Okay, you got mm-hmm. enough of that info?
Yep.
Here's his questions. We were thinking we might start Social Security for both of us this coming January 2022. But instead, if we started one of us then and waited until 70 for the other to start, would this mean that at some point, if the person who starts at age 70 passes first, the other person who started in January of 2022 will have their benefit increased to the amount of the person who passed away? I may not be explaining this very clearly, but I saw something similar to this mentioned in a recent Wall Street Journal article. I'll have you answer that one first before I get to his second question.
Okay. I totally followed what he's asking. This is a common question that if someone is delaying, in this case, to mention to 70 to maximize one of the benefits, what if they pass away before they actually start claiming? What happens to the potential delayed retirement credits they were trying to earn when it comes to a survivor benefit? The good news is, here's another simple answer for him. Yes, the survivor will get a bump up to whatever the benefit would have been when the person with the higher benefit passes away. So in other words, if he were to delay, his benefit is slightly higher. So the common approach is to maximize the higher benefit recipient. When I say common, that's for people who are wanting to make sure to have the largest survivor benefit available to whoever lives longest. The way to do that is to delay the higher benefit until 70, because the lower benefit's going to drop away no matter who passes first. That lower benefit disappears. But people are always concerned, what if I pass away and I haven't turned it on yet? Have I then, you know, lost out on this money for no benefit to my survivor? No, your survivor will get the benefit. Think of it this way. The survivor benefit is based upon whatever you were actually collecting the day you died or what you could have collected had you filed the day before you passed away. So if you think about it that way, answers the question. Right, the day you pass away, even though you hadn't filed, your survivor will have the right to claim the benefit as if you had created a benefit the day before you passed away. Now, the delayed retirement credits will no longer accrue. So you can't say delay and delay and delay until the person who passed away at, say, 68 reaches 70 and then collect all the delayed retirement credits. Unfortunately, delayed retirement credits are awarded only while you're living. So there is that. But he will, the survivor, whoever it might be, I think he mentioned in his scenario, he passes away since he's delaying. Would his wife get the bump up? Absolutely. That is exactly how it would happen. I think that was all of that particular question.
Okay. Now he has a second question. I know you covered this in the past, but I'm sure there's other listeners, too, who probably haven't heard you talk about this part. So he begins, based on the things you covered in your last podcast and some earlier ones, we understand that Social Security delayed retirement credits don't start until January of the year following when you start benefits. Does this mean that there is an advantage to starting your benefits in January or close to the end of the preceding year? In other words, starting in February could mean 11 months until the delayed retirement credits start, while starting in the previous December would have meant only 1 month of delay.
There's not generally an advantage to doing that because you remember if you claim in, say, early in the year, February or March, you're going to collect benefits for the rest of that year. So what he's asking is, should we wait until the following January to claim? Well, you're going to give up benefits for 10 months or 9 months or however long you could have been receiving benefits. And then you're going to get in January, you're going to get exactly the same benefit you would have had you started in February, plus the delayed retirement credits just for those last few months. So I don't think it's generally a benefit to do that. I would claim when you're going to claim and just know that, you know, the one thing that you will gain from that – is 10 months of one partial year's worth of credits. And it's hard to explain this verbally and not have a little chart I could draw for something. So this is really tough on a podcast. But it is true that in my example, if you were to claim in February or March, they're going to give you all the delayed retirement credits up to the previous January that you had earned. And then the couple of months of benefits of credits that you would have earned in January, February, March, maybe the beginning of that year, you won't get until the following January. And that you'll never get them. The months between the, when I say you never get them, you're never going to get credit for the March through December little bit of bump that those extra 2 or 3 months worth of delayed retirement credits would have awarded you. Those do disappear, but in the grand scheme of things, they're pretty small compared to how much benefit you're collecting during that 9-month period. So it depends a little bit on the size of your benefit, whether it makes sense or not. I should probably do the math and see if I can boil it down to a simple calculation and give people a, you know, it would help you by X percent or hurt you by X percent. I'll see if I can do that. I've never seen that calculation done, but I bet with a little Excel work on my end, this sounds like a good project for me to do some night when I'm not able to sleep. And I'll whip out Excel and see if I can figure out the kind of the trade-off formula, if you will, whether you claim in January versus February, March, April, May, etc., taking into consideration this delay of part of your delayed retirement credits not being awarded to you until the following January. If you're not sure what we're talking about there, we've done a few shows in the past on this. I'll try to make it as tight as possible. If you, say, are delaying past your full retirement age, in this case, they're 66 years old is their full retirement age, being born in 1954, and they delayed till 68, and they actually turned 68 in June of that year. If they claim in June of that year, they're not actually going to get 2 full years of delayed retirement credits immediately. They're going to get the delayed retirement credits that they earned about a year and a half's worth up until January of the year they turned 68. And then it won't be till the following January that they'll reconcile it and say, oh, look, you did earn last year 6 more months of delayed retirement credits. We'll give you that award now in January, which is 6 months after June, if you're doing the math. So that's the weird thing about the rules. The only exception to the way they do that is if you wait until 70 to claim, no matter when during the month you claim, or when during the year, I'm sorry, you turn 70 and claim, they'll give you all your delayed retirement credits immediately. They'll go out of their way to actually figure out and apply it immediately rather than waiting till the beginning of the next year to give you that partial last year's worth of delayed retirement credits. So I tried to make that as short as possible, probably lost a few people on that, but that's what they were referring to. And I'll try to, you know, my simple answer to that is no, I wouldn't intentionally delay from say March or April until January. Because I don't think, you know, the trade-off, the payback on that is going to be so far in the future, probably well past you pass away. So I don't think that's a wise decision, even though you are foregoing a few months of delayed retirement credits for the remainder of the year, not forever, just for the remainder of the year. And then they'll award them to you and you'll live out the rest of your life with full delayed retirement credits up to the point where you claimed. So those are my thoughts on it, but I've never done the math to figure out exactly what the trade-off is in simple percentage terms. But I'll if I put something together like that, I'll share it with everybody on the podcast here.
See, the thing is, we have many engineers who listen to this show. They're mm-hmm. already pulling out their Excel spreadsheets.
Probably. If somebody's already done this, send it to me, chris@jimhelps.com. I'd be happy to take a look at it. You're right. There are probably some spreadsheet nerds out there, and that I say that in an affectionate way, that have already maybe done this. I've just never run across one anywhere. I've never seen a calculator that focuses on this particular issue.
Well, now it's time to create one.
Yes, perfect.
Okay, now let's get into a few non-Social Security questions. Mm-hmm. How's that sound?
Perfect.
All righty. So the first one begins, regarding your EDU show 2110, you said that the death benefit of an annuity is considered income with respect to a decedent. Why is this? Were the premiums tax deductible? I don't think so. And if premiums are all after tax, why wouldn't the death benefit be tax free? Well, the simple answer is that's not the way annuities work. I'll get a little bit deeper into this. I did reach out to this gentleman. He is from California. We'll call him George, as always. But I did reach out to him and let him know that I probably didn't specify completely how the taxation of an annuity death benefit works. And I did concede that to him. But the only part that I didn't completely explain, Chris, is that the portion of the death benefit that represents a return of the basis in the annuity, with basis being described as the dollars that were deposited into the annuity, less any withdrawals that were taken above and beyond interest, that's your basis. Any death benefit above that is taxable. Now, there was a lot I gave in that very simple statement that I need to walk you all through to understand a few things. First, Chris, does any of what I'm about to review matter if the annuity is inside an IRA?
Not at all, because everything coming out of that IRA, regardless of the chassis that it's held in inside the IRA, is going to be taxable because it is income being distributed from an IRA at the highest level. Doesn't matter that there's an annuity inside there.
Exactly. So it does not matter, folks. If your annuity is inside an IRA, the entire death benefit is going to be taxable. If it's inside a Roth IRA, it's all tax-free, assuming it qualifies for a qualified distribution from the Roth. That's a whole other podcast, which we've done several times in the past. But the Roth payout could be tax-free if the annuity is inside a Roth. If the annuity is inside a traditional IRA, it's going to be taxable. This particular person was talking, Chris, about what we term non-qualified annuities. Mm-hmm. In short, folks, annuities not inside an IRA. Let's use, Chris, $100,000 to simply explain this, okay?
Okay.
So the client put, or a person puts in $100,000, folks, into an annuity, a deferred annuity. So it's not paying any income. It's deferred, hence the name deferred annuity. There are no required minimum distributions on deferred annuities, even though it's considered a retirement account. Even if you take money out of an annuity before the age of 59 and a half, you will pay the same 10% early withdrawal penalty. Excluding all of that, the annuity is considered a retirement account. Don't lose sight of that. So you put $100,000 into it, and let's say, Chris, it grows to $150,000, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you die. Now, there were no required minimum distributions, as I said, even though it's a retirement account, so you could die 1 year later or 20 years later. And you leave it to someone other than a spouse. If you leave it to a spouse, there's some special rules we won't get into. So you left it to a child, a friend, a neighbor, your favorite podcast host, anything like that. Without any money ever being put in again or taken out again, what would that beneficiary pay taxes on, Chris?
Took the whole thing out, you said?
Well, when you die and you're a non-spouse beneficiary, you have to close the annuity within 5 years or annuitize like we talked on a previous show.
Right.
Let's say they didn't want to annuitize and they closed it within 5 years. $150,000 originally went in.
No, person died.
Pardon?
100 went in.
100,000 went in, mm-hmm. died worth 150.
Yep.
The tax gain, the amount that's taxable will be $50,000.
The 50,000. Yep.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So pretty straightforward, folks. Makes sense so far. That's pretty understandable. He wanted to know why it didn't essentially receive a step up in basis. Because the IRS considers, as I just said, folks, annuities to be retirement accounts. Even though they're an insurance product, they're really a retirement account in the eyes of the government. And as we said repeatedly on this show, retirement accounts like IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457, TSP, you may see an asset. The government sees what, Chris?
Sees income.
Income. Income that's never been taxed. And income never receives a step up in basis at death. So all you Vanguardians out there, if you had $100,000 in the Vanguard S&P Index Fund inside a Vanguard brokerage account and you died when it was worth $150,000, so it had $50,000 of gain, and that is in a brokerage account, not an IRA, you would get you're dead. Your beneficiary would have got 100% step up in basis and wouldn't have to pay any taxes on the sale of that fund as long as they were, well,
unless there was additional gain after the death.
Yeah. Yep. Unless there was additional gain after death. So they inherited it at $150,000 and they sold it for $150,000. No taxes. That $50,000 escapes taxation. If they sold it for $160,000, $170,000, $180,000, there would be taxes. There'd be another $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 of cap gains taxes. But the $150,000 is wiped out. The $100,000 because it was basis, and basis is never taxed a second time. And $50,000 because it received a step up in basis at death. But if that same index fund was inside a variable annuity, which is a type of annuity, folks, that can hold investments. If the same scenario, that $50,000 again, because it was inside a variable annuity, the IRS considers that, even though it's identical assets, in my example, the wrapper, one was wrapped in a brokerage account that gets a step up, the other was wrapped in an annuity that doesn't get a step up in basis. That $50,000 is considered income and will be taxable to the beneficiary, not as a capital gain, but as income mm-hmm. when the annuity is closed and distributed.
Mm-hmm. But not the basis, right. But the $100,000 is still tax-free.
Correct. The $100,000, because it's basis, will not be subject to taxes. So why is it considered IRD? It's because an annuity is considered a retirement account, and retirement accounts never get a step up in basis. Now, one other thing to keep in mind as you track basis. Now, the good news is, folks, annuity companies by law have to track the basis. So don't worry about it. You don't have to be doing this. But one thing to keep in mind, let's take the same scenario, Chris. Someone has $100,000 that they put into a brokerage account and it grew to $150,000. Somebody has $100,000 that they put into an annuity and it grew to $150,000. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there's $50,000 again in each account, correct?
Yes.
The brokerage person, folks, if they want it, and they'd have to really play with the numbers, but you can do a type of accounting called specific share identification, where if you needed a $10,000 distribution from the brokerage account, you could go in there and perhaps manipulate certain shares and say, wow, if I sell these shares and those shares, even though I have a $50,000 gain, I can release that $10,000 with zero gain. or maybe a little bit of gain in one, a little bit of loss in the other. They equal each other out, and I can get the $10,000 out without owing any taxable gain. Correct, Chris?
Yes.
Could you do the same thing with that annuity?
No, because everything that comes out of that, it's treated differently.
It is.
For taxation.
You cannot do specific share identification in an annuity. The accounting in an annuity is LIFO, L-I-F-O, prior to, gosh, I can't remember.
Like
I want to say 83. Is it 80? I forget.
83 or 84, somewhere in there.
Prior to a tax law change in the early 80s, the accounting on annuities were FIFO, first in, first out, meaning you could do exactly what I just described. You could have gone to the annuity company and said, hey, I put in $100,000 to this annuity. It's worth $150,000. I need $10,000. I don't feel like paying any taxes. Just send me $10,000 of my basis.
Well, they wouldn't let you pick it. It literally came out.
Right. FIFO.
FIFO, correct. Period. So you're going to get a return of principal first under FIFO. We don't talk about that much anymore because unless your annuity is pre-1983, I think it was 83 now that I say it out loud, and my brain is registering more with that. The new rules apply, which is LIFO, last in, first out. And the last in, gain.
Is interest. Yep. Your earnings are always last. Basis goes in first. Earnings comes out last.
Well, doesn't come out.
Earnings is put in last.
Put in last from the company as they're crediting the account. So when you go try to take money out, the last that got credited in there, that's coming out first. So 100% taxable on those earnings, the first, until you get down to principal. Then it suddenly becomes tax-free.
Correct. So under this accounting, if the living person takes $10,000 out, it's going to be $10,000 of earnings, meaning the basis remains untouched. Meaning if they then died, there's still $100,000 of basis that the beneficiary will receive tax-free, and only $40,000, Chris, of gain that will be subject to income taxes. Now, under FIFO accounting, if basis comes out first and the person died, they would not be the same. There would only be $90,000 of basis and still $50,000 again subject to the beneficiary. So FIFO and LIFO actually helps, well, LIFO actually helps your beneficiary, but it hurts you because interest always comes out of an annuity first, whereas in a brokerage account, you can kind of manipulate things using an accounting called specific share identification.
And this, of course, is an annuity that has not yet been annuitized.
Correct.
So just for those keeping track at home, make sure you understand what we're talking about here. Funds that can be withdrawn from an annuity situation, in this case the deferred annuity like Jim is describing, has not yet been annuitized. Rules change once the annuitization happens.
Right. That's a whole other rule.
Whole other
so
show,
anyways, yeah. Folks, that's just what I wanted you to know. I didn't specify that, but the death benefit is taxable to the extent it exceeds your basis.
Yep.
So do keep that in mind. So the insurance company will figure out basis because interest is always credited to your annuity every year. Unless you have an index annuity that happened to pay zero that year. Other than that, most annuities will pay something every year. Same thing with a variable annuity, though. You might not get any earnings in that. And we very rarely use variable annuities. So on a fixed annuity side, you're probably getting interest every year, especially if you have like a MIGA, which pays a set amount of interest every year. So if you take withdrawals on regular basis from annuities, how much that's taxable to you every year, Chris, changes based on how much earnings you get in it each year. So that's why the insurance company tracks it, folks, not you. Don't worry. The IRS mandates they have to. Now, the good news is they do all the work. The bad news is you can't argue the point. It's what they say their numbers show. So a lot of you number crunchers, you might start saying, well, wait a minute, they're making a mistake. And if they do, then you have to argue with the insurance company. And I don't know what's worse, arguing with an insurance company or a stubborn dog. Okay. This next one I wanted to get to because it's kind of applicable right now with tax season. Unfortunately, it's not going to quite work out the way this man hopes, but I'll begin. Hello, guys. I really enjoy your show. My name is, we're going to pause there. I'm going to call him George, like mm-hmm. we always do, even though he gave his full name. And I am from the sunny state of Georgia. Hmm. As a result, I hate Tom Brady more than you do. Well, he did kind of burst the bubble of the Atlanta Braves. You got to admit that. That was a phenomenal Super Bowl comeback.
The Falcons, not the Braves. The Braves are a baseball team, Mr.
Oh,
Football.
See, I got baseball on my mind. Well, I'm sure he bummed out the Braves, too, because
probably.
They're from Atlanta.
True. He bummed out everybody in Atlanta.
Anyways, he says, I took a $100,000 CRD in in 2020 from my IRA. Mm-hmm. Chris, do you want to explain to people who may not know what I just said in English?
That is a coronavirus-related distribution, which gets special rules if it qualifies as a CRD. There's special rules with what you can and cannot do with that money that you took out. And he took one out in 2020 during the coronavirus epidemic, which is
correct.
Still lingering on today. But
I took from my IRA in 2020 to take advantage of the CARES Act, as I did qualify because I was laid off in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. So during the pandemic, just hitting, guy lost his job.
Yep.
He was allowed to take money out of his IRA as a coronavirus-related distribution, folks. You could take out up to $100,000. You did not need to show any type of financial impact. He doesn't have to prove to the IRS he spent that $100,000 on helping himself.
Right.
He could have suffered no financial hardship. The mere fact that he lost his job due to COVID allowed him to take $100,000 out. Congress also gives him 3 years to pay the taxes on that. Now, we talked many a times on this show, Chris, this gentleman's going to have two choices. He can pay the taxes all this year, which is technically for last year. So he can pay it all for 2020 when he files his taxes by May 5th or 17th of this year, or he can spread the taxes out by declaring as income a third, and a third of the $100,000 for 2020, 2021, and 2022's taxes. Mm-hmm. Those are his two options. Mm-hmm. Okay, folks, so now you kind of get that.
Unless he's going to put it back.
And that's what he gets into.
Okay.
So let's jump into the rest of his question. It's my understanding that I need to put this $100,000 back into an IRA within 3 years to avoid paying any income tax. Let me pause there, folks and listener. Your understanding is correct, but the IRS does not wait for their taxes.
Right.
You have two choices. Declare it all as income for last year, which is technically this year. You do 2020's taxes in early 2021. But you can declare it all on 2020's taxes this year as you do them. And if you end up paying it back the last year, 3 years later, you'll get a refund for the taxes you paid. But they're going to want it all this year, or a third. They're not going to give you 3 years to pay the taxes. You can't go 0, 0, 100. So do keep that in mind, listener and listeners. So
it'll all eventually come out in the wash, but there's this timing issue. You're going to have to pay the taxes as if you owed them under as if you're going to keep it until you actually pay it back, and then you essentially reconcile it at that time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And what you do to pay the taxes is you just declare the money as income, 100% all in 2020, or a third in 2020, a third in 2021, and a third in 2022. So I was right before when I misspoke when I said 2023. 2022 is the last year to pay it all back. But you declare it as income in those years, and you pay taxes based on the income of each year. If you have very low income in 1 year, you may want to declare it all in 2020. If you never went back to work, listener, and you were just collecting unemployment, and let's say you got a kid and a wife and some good deductions and your child tax care credits, declaring it all as income in 2020 might make sense. So you got to really look at it because it's subject to the taxes in the year you declare it. Okay, so he goes on. I have also heard, though, that the IRS, at least currently, doesn't have any rule against me putting that $100,000 back into a Roth IRA instead of an IRA. If I were to put the $100,000 back into a Roth sometime within the next 3 years, do I have to pay taxes on that still? Thanks again for any help. Do you want to burst his bubble or you want me to?
Yeah, one way or another, you're going to pay taxes on it unless you put it back. And eventually,
into an
it's going to
IRA,
come,
right, a unless you put it back. Traditional IRA. Right.
And then eventually, it's going to be taxed when it comes out. So at one point, bottom line, you can't get the money out of an IRA for your own use without paying the tax bill that has never been paid yet. So if you turn around and put it back in a Roth, you're right. The IRS does not prohibit that. But you're going to owe the taxes like Jim just described a moment ago, either 100% in 2020 tax year or a third, and a third. You got to choose which one of those you're going to do if you're going to leave it in a Roth or leave it in your pocket. Either way, the taxes are going to be the same way. And you notice I said if there's no way to get it out for your own use without paying the taxes, there is a little way to get never taxed money out and still never taxed. And what's that, Jim?
A little way you threw me for a loop on that because someone wasn't paying attention.
That's okay. How can what's really the only way that if you put pre-tax money in an IRA, so a traditional IRA, it come out and never be taxed?
Give it to charity.
There you go. Bingo. That's why I said specifically for your own use. Because there's technically a way for it to come out not taxed, but
as
guess
a QCD
what?
After you're, age 70
right,
and a half.
You're not gonna get it. You're not gonna get it tax free. If you're taking it out like you're describing, one way or another, taxes are going to be owed. You have some flexibility on declaring it 100% in 2020 or do the third, third, and the third because it qualified as a CRD. But yeah, if you were hoping for some loophole where it was going to end up in the Roth and you weren't going to pay taxes or you were going to be given 3 years to then pay the taxes, no. Those are not options.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, listener. And remember, only after-tax money can go into a Roth. So they're not going to let you take $100,000 out of your IRA under the Coronavirus Act, the CARES Act, and then put it into a Roth IRA tax-free, and then let it grow and take the growth out tax-free. They love you, but they don't love you that much. So there's no problem putting it into I say there's no problem because right now we have no guidance from the IRS on if they have no problem with it going into a Roth, but there is nothing against it. Ed Slott has said repeatedly, folks, it violates, in his opinion, the spirit of the law, but it does not violate the law. My personal take is, Chris, the government isn't going to care if he puts it into a Roth. They get tax money right away. Right. And the way they're spending money, like drunk sailors on shore leave, they want all the money they can get.
Yep.
Okay. So, next question. Mm-hmm. Says, hi, Jim, Chris, and Brett. So Brett's going to be very happy. He
wow.
got a shout out.
Yeah.
Brett is our admin, for those who don't know. If you ever called the office, you dealt with him. But Brett is our wonderful admin. But hi, Jim, Chris, and Brett. According to my retirement plan, my secure income is going to be a little bit short. Therefore, I'm planning on buying a SPIA to cover the shortfall. I'm going to pause there, and Chris is going to put in English what that man just said.
A SPIA is a type of income annuity, kind of the cleanest, most basic form of an income annuity, in our opinion. SPIA stands for Single Premium Immediate Annuity, which implies or essentially describes the case where you put a single premium, you pay one lump sum in exchange the insurance company is going to, quote, immediately start paying you an annuitized amount. Immediately means within 13 months, so essentially within a year, has to start by rule. So anything beyond that, it becomes a deferred annuity and therefore is not a SPIA. But that's what he's talking about, is turning a lump sum of money into an income stream for life via an insurance product called a single premium immediate annuity.
Correct. Not to be confused with, do you remember several years ago, this is probably going back 7 or 8 years, you won't remember this, but I do. There was an insurance hack on local radio out here. And he was talking about helping people open the purest form of annuity, Chris, a SPIA, that if you go to see him, he's going to help you open the purest annuity you can, a SPIA, single premium indexed annuity.
I know that was, yeah, that made, I remember that. That made my skin crawl as well, because that person.
Because that's BS.
That's not what SPIA stands for. What he was selling was not the purest form. He was selling indexed annuities, which are very much different than a
totally SPIA, different
single premium immediate annuity.
Okay, so let's continue. Over the years, I have heard about annuities which can be bought without paying a commission to the insurance agent. Since I know what I want and I have done the homework and I don't need any hand-holding, I am interested in how one would qualify to purchase such an annuity. I assume that annuity should pay me a slightly higher rate. Can you explain how these annuities work? Do all insurance companies offer them, or only a select few? Thanks. And he left his name. I gotta say, I'm not gonna say his name. I like his name. That's a cool name. Left his name, and he's in the fine state of Colorado.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
We are too.
Another Coloradoan. Mm-hmm. We've talked about these annuities in the past, listeners mm-hmm. and listener, and a couple of things. You are not, I repeat, you are not going to find an insurance agent who will sell you these annuities. Because the insurance agent has nothing against. And if you are an insurance agent, please, I'm a licensed insurance producer in the state of Colorado as well. I am not bashing agents. I am not bashing annuities and insurance. Please, I'm just trying to educate my listeners on how the industry works. So chill out with the negative comments or emails. But insurance agents, Chris, they make money through a commission. Mm-hmm. They don't have a business structure that allows them to charge someone a fee and forego the commission. So because these annuities of which you speak, listener, would not pay an insurance agent anything, and because he or she, as a pure insurance agent, does not have a business model that allows them legally to charge you for financial planning advice, even though it doesn't sound like advice when you walk into someone's office and say, I want to buy this annuity, it's still considered in the eyes of the regulators financial advice. You need a Series 65 to do that. You need to be an IAR, an investment advisor representative. You need to be able to charge for your time to give advice. So they're not going to be able to do that. So the fact is, most insurance agents don't offer those annuities. Now, you could have insurance agents like myself who also has a firm called a registered investment advisor. Not me. I'm not an RIA, and I can't advertise as an RIA. I have a firm that's registered as an RIA, Jim Saulnier and Associates. Follow me so far? Not everyone. They can't answer. Do you think they follow me so far, Chris?
Yeah, that's confused a lot. But people are not RIAs. RIAs are business entities. Those that work inside the RIA are, and confusingly enough, the same three letters, IARs, Investment Advisor Representatives.
Correct. So an RIA is a firm, just like I have, that's done the licensing. There's no test. There's no nothing. And so if anybody ever markets to you listeners, oh, I'm an RIA. I'm great. I'm the next thing best to slice bread. No,
they
filled
fill
in a boatload of paperwork and filed some paperwork with the SEC and their state regulator, and now they're an RIA. That's all it takes. It's a boatload of paperwork, though, that I'll tell you. Okay, so anyways, back to your question, listener. So do these annuities exist? Yes. Can you walk into an insurance agent's office and buy them? Probably not, unless that insurance agent also has or works as an investment advisor representative for an RIA, registered investment advisor. They are allowed to charge a fee. And in fact, a year and a half ago, the IRS changed the rules on annuities in a way to promote wider adoption in the insurance world of these annuities by allowing RIA firms who want to offer these annuities to debit their fee directly from the annuity, much like an AUM asset manager who's out there. You know those guys who want to charge 1% of assets, Chris, to quote-unquote manage your assets. They'll pull that money right from your account. And if they're pulling it from an IRA, you as the owner of that IRA, you don't have to pay taxes on that fee as it goes to the advisor. It actually comes out of your IRA tax-free. It's kind of a little benefit for paying your investment management fee from
pre-tax.
Your IRA directly.
Yeah.
You could never do that with annuities. And because of that, RIAs weren't offering them because they couldn't debit their fee. The client would have to pay separately, or if the fee was taken from the annuity, there'd be income taxes owed and maybe a 10% early withdrawal penalty if the client was younger than 59 and a half.
Right.
So for years, these annuities went nowhere. Then they changed the rules. So do keep in mind, you can go to an RIA now and possibly buy these. Most RIAs don't offer them because they either don't know they exist or they don't understand insurance because they still have to have an insurance license to offer them. And they don't want to deal with getting an insurance license. A good insurance representative or agent is worth his or her weight in gold because they know a lot about insurance. And they don't want to deal with it and get it. But you might be able to find someone who offers them. But do keep in mind, even though they're not being paid a commission, they are going to charge you a fee for opening them. So you have got to compare what they are going to charge you and how much they're going to charge you and how often they're going to charge it to what you would pay for a commissioned product. Mm-hmm. It might be cheaper to actually pay the insurance commission, which is only levied once and paid once to the insurance agent, as opposed to a fee that may occur over and over again by the RIA. All RIAs are going to be different if they offer these at all. Do keep in mind as well, very few insurance companies have what we in the industry call RIA-friendly annuities.
Right.
You can still find some out there. Nationwide has one on the variable side that is not going to pay an income benefit, which is what you want. The only annuity that's going to fit what you want, listener, because you say you want a SPIA, is a SPIA. You want a SPIA, you got to buy a single premium immediate annuity. And I know of only one insurance company that offers a commission-free SPIA. That is it.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of competition in that space. Whereas there is a lot of competition in the traditional commission-paying
mission space
SPIAs, And even then, just so you know, of all the annuities out there, the commission structure on SPIAs is quite low. So you're actually not burdening the income stream with a really high commission typically with a SPIA. So I think when you compare them, you might find that there's not a lot of difference. And you might even, because of the competition on the commission SPIA side, the traditional SPIA side, might be in just pretty much just as good a position and have a lot less headache trying to find one because of the lack of choices in the RIA-friendly no-commission SPIA, which is a population right now, we believe, of only one company.
Right. So what Chris said is 100% correct, and do keep that in mind, that the commissions on SPIAs are the lowest commissions of any insurance, any annuity product out there. That is why you see a lot of insurance agents themselves hardly ever recommending them.
Yeah.
You don't get paid much, usually between 0.5% and 2% of what you put in is what the agent will get. But he and she gets it once, and they have to service that annuity for life. It's a lifelong annuity. They're on the hook for servicing that 5 years into it, 10 years into it, 15 years into it, until you finally die. So they're not very profitable. They do, for the insurance agent, they do present a lot of work. So you often find a lot of people don't offer them. Chris and I do, because we actually like them. From everything that I'm saying right now about them is the reasons why Chris and I actually like them. They don't pay us very much. They do pay a lot to the client as income, but it's a guaranteed lifetime stream, and the insurance company is taking the risk, yada, yada, yada. You guys all know that. But what I would suggest, anyone out there who's looking for these commission-free insurance, always compare it to commissioned products. And for all you MYGA fans out there that are growing in popularity in these low interest rate environments, there are no commission-free MYGAs out there. It's very rare to find commission-free insurance. Most commission-free annuities are on the deferred indexed annuity side and the variable side. And on the variable side, they are just a wrapper to give some tax benefits. We'll talk on a future show what those benefits would be. So most commission-free annuities right now are on the indexed annuity side, those annuities that I've been talking about recently. And they do pay more to you, the client, more interest credits than you could get in a commission-sold one. But you then have to find out from the investment advisor representative offering those, what are you going to charge me? It's great, I'm getting more on the gross level. You're still going to take some. How often are you going to take it, and how much are you taking? And you've got to compare the net to you after that calculation, and then compare it to a commission sold annuity where the fee is that the agent earns is rolled right into the product. That's really all they're doing, Chris, is they unbundled the fee that goes to the agent or advisor. And the agent or advisor has to show the fee or tell the fee or negotiate the fee with the client. So that's all they're trying to do on these products. Anyways, I hope that ends a little bit more clarity to this.
Perfect. Well, that's going to wrap the show for today. Got through 5 questions, and actually a couple of them were multi-part questions. So I would maybe count it as more than 5 questions. So we did a pretty good job shoving 5 plus into an hour. So we want to thank everybody for listening once again to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. If you have your own questions that you'd like to submit for our attempts at answers here on the show, go to the website jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can submit your questions that way. You can learn a little bit more about us and what we do on there as well if you're a new listener. You can also send the emails directly to Jim, the questions directly to his email, jim@jimhelps.com. He loves to get them that way. He sorts them into his electronic folders and then prints them out.
I do. I have a stack of them in front of me right now.
So, not the most eco-friendly approach, but, you know, we all have our vices. And I admit I'm more of a paper guy, too. I'm complaining about Jim as I'm staring right here at a pile of papers I've put together for a discussion with a client that I have here in a little bit. Because it is easier for me, too, to shuffle through papers than to click through windows on my computer as I'm talking to someone. So, maybe someday we can wean ourselves.
Don't underestimate the power of paper.
Yeah, I get it. Until it gets lost, and then it's a real bummer. But,
or someone steals Social Security questions someone nameless did once.
Or a mouse sneaks out of the bathroom and eats it or carries it off into the lair. I don't know what happened. Something could have happened there. So,
yeah.
But thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with another show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.